picked the wrong team, it's game over. But the right team, now that can change everything. Picture this. One founder met their co-founder on Upwork. Yes, Upwork, and it worked out. Another founder went through four CTOs before finding their perfect fit.
Perfect.
Some founders chose to split after their first venture, others stuck together and rode the waves of failure before finally building the business that made it all click. Today, on The Startup Leap, we're diving deep into what it takes to build a high-performing team from day one. You hear firsthand from founders who've built billion-dollar fintechs, launched consumer tech companies serving millions of users, and others who've created breakthrough companies in the AI space. Get ready for hard-won lessons and an inside scoop into building teams that can scale a vision. So what are you waiting for? Grab those headphones and let's dive in.
Welcome to The Startup Leap, the number one podcast interviewing startup founders who have taken the leap into starting their own businesses.
Here on The Startup Leap, we hear real, raw and relatable stories of these entrepreneurs, how they've navigated taking the leap and the decisions they've made. We're your hosts.
I'm Yvonne.
And I'm Maria.
And this is the Startup Leap podcast.
Yvonne and Maria are partners at Local Globe and OpenSeed VC, respectively. Local Globe and OpenSeed are independent of the Startup Leap podcast. Any statements made by Maria, Yvonne, or the Startup Leap guests are solely their view and are not advice. Endorsements by the Startup Leap, its guests, Maria and Yvonne.
Welcome to another episode of The Startup Leap. Now, today we're going to do something slightly different. We're going to do a reflection episode where we look back on some of our most recent episodes and we're going to dive into team. As we all know that building a team when you're working on creating a world-class company is one of the most challenging things.
Yeah, so stay tuned and enjoy a few clips of some of our episodes and the conversations they've had reflecting on the team.
I wanted to just dissect the team a little bit, because I know that one of the things that you speak a lot about is culture and building teams. And if we think about culture, you know, they say that strategy, culture, like culture definitely is really key when you're building our team. This is your fourth company, right? Mm-hmm. And so just really keen to understand how you navigated building out that culture and how intentional you were about it.
Very. And again, love that question. Thank you. Yeah, I think one of my favorite quotes is that culture is strategy for breakfast or lunch and dinner. Maybe all of the meals. It's been really interesting on two, maybe three accounts. One is, as I said before, I started the company with a scientist and with an environmentalist. And if you haven't already picked up on the fact that I'm generally the sort of more hippie, let's change the world for the better, rather than, oh, Sharky, let's like make as much money as we can and like leave people on the streets. Well, this is the first time in my career that suddenly I am the scary finance person. And my co-founders looked at me and were like, does she have good intentions? Does she really want to do the right thing for the planet? Or is she maybe just another tech bro who sort of, you know, saw that there is some money to be raised now in climate, and maybe she's just like all of them. So it actually started from me and my co-founders needing to have the trust in each other. They needed to trust that I wanted to build a commercially successful company that will grow really big, but also will stop climate change and will treat people with respect. And I needed to know in them that they had the ambition to build a massive company as well as stop climate change. And, you know, very interesting things happened in the process. You know, we raised our pre-seed last year, and during that process, sort of Mark realized that actually he'd rather be an ambassador to the company than be an executive, and that is completely fine. And he's still doing a brilliant job, just in a different seat. And Gabriel and I are running the company with our exec team. But sort of just the shape of the founding team was quite unusual and sort of very diverse in many ways because of our backgrounds. So that was the first thing that we needed to talk a lot about. What is the culture and sort of what is the goal? How are we going to align on a shared vision of success? Yeah. What does success look like? And we think success is a role in which carbon removals play a meaningful role in creating a livable planet and a regenerative economy. So again, we think a lot about the social impact that goes off the back of the climate impact that we achieve. And then for the team, I think while so many startups are doing an incredible job and solving lots of problems and creating opportunity. Mm. I also think the whole startup culture is often incredibly toxic. Mm. And I...
Say more.
Well, have we heard of tech bros? I think a lot of it is driven... I mean, there are very... It's actually really sad, but when I think of people who are universally understood to be the most successful entrepreneurs of our time, I don't have any respect for them. So when I think about how value is perceived in the startup world, and a lot of that is, I'm sorry, lady investor and lady investor, a lot of it is driven by what investors consider to be value. Mm. You know, paying your employees well and treating them well doesn't always have a dollar number associated with it. Well, in fact, it does, but you have to make a more complex case that these things actually will pay off and bring more value to your company, whereas being able to, you know, working your people 100 hours a week and not paying them well, you know, it is an easier way of explaining how you're a, you know, an ambitious CEO and making the most out of your team. So a lot of the practices in tech, I don't sign up to. I don't want to work like this. I don't want to treat people like this. We started Curate as saying that it was a matriarchy because all of our most senior positions at the beginning, bar one, were held by women. I have an all-female board.
I love that.
It's sort of not really by design. It so happened to be the case, but also then I realized I don't know anybody else who has that. The bulk of my cap table are women and people of color. I was trying to be really intentional about, you know, this is my fourth company. I think I have a reasonably good chance of making it a success. Then who do I want to make rich? Guess what? You know, I then sort of ended up with a slightly different shape of my cap table. And then a lot of the people that work at Curate are parents of small children. I have absolutely no idea how they do it.
How did you think about the early, you know, versions of who you built that with?
Well, there were three of us founded the company. One guy with a background in marketing, he'd built a hugely successful marketing agency. Another guy with a background in, I'm going to call it big tech. So he understood tech infrastructure. None of us with any banking or finance background. Me, contact centers, websites, e-com. So we set about, you know, the first hires were plugging the holes and some feet on the ground to do some of the work. Mr. Marketing left very, very early on. Mr. Big Tech stayed with us probably 2 years. He's still not involved with the business, but he is still a huge supporter of the business. And I was about to say I remained the last man standing, which is kind of ironic when they were both men and I'm female. But yeah, last man standing. And we built the team slowly. The first hire, a lady called Ruth, we brought in to help project manage the build and set up operations. Mm-hmm. She's still with us today. She's our vice president of operations, runs our customer support team and operations team, banking and investment ops. So she's got about 140 people reporting into her now. And, you know, it's amazing to see people you hire
very early
when there's three of you or five of you or 12 of you. And actually that was a real learning for me, watching how people evolve and then the different types of people you need at different stages of the business. I mean, Ruth's a fantastic example. She has just flown the entire time and grown and been interested and wanted to and been great at taking all of that on. But like me, she's had to adapt what she does on a day-to-day basis 50 times over the last, you know, I joke sometimes you have to reinvent the company every 6 months if you're growing fast. You really do. And as a leader, you have to reinvent your own role, you know.
I completely agree with this. Mm. And what I found is like, in businesses, you almost need certain people for certain stages.
Yeah.
And some are relevant very early. As you grow, the skill sets that you need is completely different.
Yeah.
I even have this thing where I feel like at tech startups, the first 3 years, at the third year, there's often a massive churn.
Yes. I would agree with you. I would agree with you. The people that you need who are happy to get their hands dirty, do anything, you know, literally that might be painting the toilet in the new office you've just moved into and then having a conversation with the regulator 5 minutes later. Those people might not be happy doing what we need now with 2.5 million customers in 5 countries and, you know, that sort of thing. Other people adapt and morph and grow and are happy the whole journey. But yeah, you're absolutely right. There are definitely different shapes of role at different stages of the company.
And I guess, you know, building a team is incredibly hard, right? Mm. You can say it's an art more than a science. In hindsight, is there anything that you would have done differently building out the team back then and as the company's evolved as well?
I've always worked on the mantra of hire people who are smarter than you are. So, again, maybe this is part of the, I don't know, maybe that's part of the confidence my parents gave me. But I'm not scared if somebody comes in who knows loads more than me. I'm delighted because it's like, great, you do this bit. and, you know, when you sometimes listen to people saying, you have to know all the detail in all the areas. You can't possibly. You can when you're tiny, when it's a tiny company, but you can't possibly if you're going to scale that company successfully. And actually, to that point, I'm trying to think how many years ago it was now, but certainly 5 years ago, it might have been a little bit longer than that, 6, 7 years ago, we got to a point where I realised I'd become a bit of a blocker, which was a bit of a shock, but I realised, well, I was drowning. That was the first sign. I was absolutely drowning. And when I tried to unpick why was I drowning, it was because everybody was coming to me to ask me stuff, not to check in for permission to do it, because they had permission to do it, but because they needed to know where something was or why something was built like this or who was the right person to talk to. And I realised that I had created that roadblock. And so I set up a campaign across the company called Single Points of Failure and said, right, we are going to identify in every team, not just people, but suppliers, processes, where there are single points of failure, and we're going to do our best to eradicate them. And oh my God, my name came up an awful lot. It really did. It was a shock. It was a shock. And I realized just how much information was in my head. And so, you know, if anybody's listening out there and scaling their business or planning to, watch out for that and make sure. I delegated permission to do stuff, but I definitely hadn't let go of enough information or put it in the right places to let people just get on without needing to come and find me.
Iss and I met, Iss actually interviewed me the first time we met. We ended up being on the same grad scheme together. And I think like any relationship, you just find things to talk about when you don't have to. That's a sign of a good relationship. You just want to speak to each other. And we used to speak about, you know, music, and he knew so much about the rappers in the UK and I was fascinated, or we would talk about sport or anything. And I can remember we used to have a pinball machine in our old office, and I remember standing there chatting to him, and I, you know, when you hang up and you see how long you spoke to him for, I was like, oh my God, it was an hour. I was like, weird. Like, and just the kind of random person in your life. And then when we were considering setting it up, I mean, who you do it with is everything. Yeah. And I think for us, it just felt like the right pairing, and we brought different things to the table that maybe each other didn't have so much. And it just became this really nice symbiotic relationship. You spend a hell of a lot of time with that person.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that the biggest kind of root cause of most startups failing is co-founders breaking up.
Like,
and I'm actually writing a blog on about this week, but it always comes back to the people. Yeah. Everything is the people, the taste they have, the approach they have. And there's this kind of myth which seems to be propagating, which is that it's about the tools, it's about the tech. It's like there are puppet masters of those things. Yeah. They don't just sort of come to exist.
Yeah.
And I think we have a very short-term memory. You know, I would argue the wheel was just as transformative a piece of technology as AI is going to be. Humans figured out how to master the wheel and, you know, insert various other things. We're going to do a really good job of making sure this thing works for us. And in the end, it's going to be, right, who are the, you know, if there's a new tool and it becomes ubiquitous, the best tool master is the most important person in the world. So for me, it was just, this is a, you know, the highest integrity person I've really met. And I just thought, you know, who better to jump into?
How did you have the conversation? Was it like a natural, organic thing? Was it a, hey, this is, you know, what I'm thinking about? Did he know about the, like, did you both talk about the idea very early on and it was a natural transition that you would build it together? I'd love to get into a bit of that. The reason why I ask is because we have quite a few people in different spaces in their journey listening or watching, and they probably have a few people in mind that they're thinking about, or maybe one person. But some people, you know, are anxious about the conversation more than others, or don't quite know how. We've had founders who've been like, you know, take you to a pub, hey, this is what I'm doing. We've had founders that have
quite
been
aggressive.
Like,
it's interesting because I've seen how Entrepreneur First, they've done amazingly well. It seems like they pump out unicorns and more power to them. Instinctively, I don't understand how that model works, where it's sort of like, I don't think you can be like, I want to be a founder. I think that's a weird mindset to me. I think you have to start with, do we both see a problem the same way? And do we think that this solution or this product might ameliorate that problem? Clearly, I'm wrong because EF have done very, very well. But at least that's my...
But two things can be true.
And for us, I don't think either of us are ever like, we want to be tech founders and, you know, I actually have our Patagonia jacket, but like we wear a Patagonia jacket.
To fix that.
Yeah. I don't think that was ever the intention, but it... I think we fell in love with the problem.
Right.
We really were like, wow, this is cooked. Like, how do we change this? Are we the right people to change this? And I think it's a very, starting a company is a very vulnerable journey because you have to get, you have to allow yourself to be wrong the whole time. And Is has a great phrase, which he uses often, which is kind of strong beliefs loosely held. And I think that is incredibly relevant very early on, because one morning you have to wake up and be like, this is the plan. This is what we're doing. And the next morning it's like, that's the plan. But like, you can't be too hard on yourself because your job is to, a bit like a truffle pig, respond to different scents. Where are you picking up real customer love? Which bits of the product that you thought were going to be really important aren't? And I think a willingness to let go of what you used to cherish is just part and parcel in that early stage. As you go on, I think it's almost the inverse, and it's, you have to be brave enough to really double down on the stuff that works versus letting go. And that is the sort of phase we're in now, where it's like, we have these things that have been very successful in a Petri dish. How do we really explode those?
And you spoke about the importance of people, which I fundamentally believe, like, people is everything when it comes to startups. How did you think about your early hires? What roles did you optimize for? And culture as well. So as the company has now evolved through to Series A, how has your thinking around culture shifted?
So our early hires, I mean, honestly, anyone who is mad enough to join us in a basement in Farringdon was welcome. But we prioritized for care. There's a really good video, I don't know if you can include it in the show notes or something, with the president of Blackstone. It's his commencement speech or advice to new grads joining Blackstone. And he goes on basically about the only thing that matters being care for your clients, you know, for our customers. And I do think that differentiates most people, is do they see it as a job or do they see it as like a privilege to do the work?
Right.
And I think everyone we've hired, the red thread is, of course they get it's just a job, and you know, family and health and all this stuff are 10x more important. But when things go wrong, it should really matter. You should feel it. And I think there are too many businesses where I look at the DNA of the company from the founders down, it doesn't really matter to them. Mm. It's like, great, we signed a new logo, or that customer's upset, or I'm going to go home now. You kind of got to feel it in your loins. Yeah. And I don't know how you teach that or coach that, but usually what we found, the folks who do really well for us are people who we kind of put ahead of their experience stage. Okay. So what I felt when I did the Miami job was I had absolutely no right to do that job. You know, I didn't have the experience, but what I had was like total care that everything I did was going to I was going to do it so well. And no, you know, if anyone checked my homework, it would be correct. And for the folks we like to hire, we like to say, look, a 37-year-old should be doing this job. You're 23. We're going to treat you like you're 37. Mm. Let's go. And people, at least the people we hire, love being treated like real adults.
Yeah.
And I think there are too many businesses who kind of sit people in a hierarchy and say, stay there till you're arbitrage. Mm. Stay there till you're arbitrage. Stay there. And the best people can never be capped in that way. Yeah. So we're looking for these sort of irrepressible people that keep showing you that they're ready for the next jump.
Yes, like I wanted to work in food and on, and specifically in New York City. So that box was checked. You know, more specifically, I was very excited about the fast casual segment of the restaurant industry, which, you know, I spent a little bit of time learning about Shake Shack and was really inspired by Chipotle. And I was just fascinated that there was kind of this new category of restaurants that felt recession-proof, where there was a lot of opportunity to create value and grow. So there was some kind of initial alignment around the market and the market segment and the location.
This is becoming a thing beyond just a research project.
Right.
Need the first, you know, people on board. Yeah. I can't do it alone, or I don't want to do it alone. How did you navigate your co-founder? Where did you meet them? Mm-hmm. How did you think about who was a fit? And how did you have the conversation as well? Because it's also, it's like, was it just a natural, you guys just knew, or is it more like an upfront conversation as well?
Yeah, so my co-founder with...
How many co-founders?
The two co-founders, okay. Yeah. And one co-founder, we graduated, and this was our graduation project together. Okay. So Daniela and I were already kind of in it.
And like did you both worked at Jaguar together?
Yeah. We both worked at JLR together as well. And that was more like, back and forth kind of conversations. Like, do we really want to do this? Yeah. She's from Mexico, right? So like we both needed visas. Yeah. And, you know, ultimately we decided to give it a year. It went beyond that a bit, but, you know, we still kind of stuck through it. But neither of us have that depth and technical background and knowledge. So we knew that we needed to bring someone in on that front. Yeah. So we went on Upwork and we found an engineer on Upwork. Yeah. Okay.
I love this.
And that was Daniel. And so brought Daniel in as a contractor, and I paid him out of my salary essentially from Jaguar, you know, just kind of like, we got obviously.
And was he full time at that point? Or was he?
No. He was contractor. Okay. So we were just
also got some time to work together and kind of see if there was even like opportunity
for us. Exactly.
And then when was it? Cause I feel as if like quite a lot of people are quite hesitant to bring someone in as a co-founder, right? So when did you have that aha moment that he was the one?
Or was it just logical? It was just like so natural. It was like, hey, let's just...
I think I started to see like more and more we worked together, the more and more he would bring up ideas or things that like I hadn't even thought about, right? It was like, okay, this guy's actually thinking beyond just like, you know, here's an executable, here's the brief. Yeah. But also we started to run out of money, right? So I'm like, at a certain point, like, I'm not going to be able to pay you to do this. Are you enjoying this? Yeah. And so... at the time, actually, the three of us went to my hometown. We went to Portland. I was just like, let's get out of London. Let's go and like, I feel like if you take people outside of the working environment,
you get to meet them.
You need to have a bit of reference for one another as human beings, right? Yeah. And so we went and actually stayed at my family home, and we did really weird, quirky Portland things, and went on hikes and stuff like this, and then. You know, I just presented the idea to Daniel and Danielle, like, why don't we bring Daniel in as a co-founder? Yeah. And, you know, he resonated with the idea, and obviously hashing out, like, what the package would be and, you know, the equity and all that stuff is always a bit of a tricky thing. But ultimately, he just really loved the mission that we were on.
He's still with the business today.
And still with the business today, yeah.
But it's ironic and you know, somewhat unfortunate that, you know, you had to go through all of that and de-risk the business before, you know, people start seeing it. But from an investor's perspective, you should be investing before it's obvious.
and backing on that journey. I wanted to talk a little bit about how you thought about the team, because with your product, you mentioned it's complex. It's like, it's pretty much a, you mentioned the new category, like a product relationship management software. And for, especially for regulated financial services, I can imagine, I'm just thinking about the product build. I'm thinking about the type of expertise you would have needed. Someone who's probably done it before or understands how the requirements for these larger organizations, knowing that that's some of the reasons it might take longer to onboard. So I'm wondering how you thought about getting from that MVP that probably was just like getting an idea to the next version. How did you think of your co-founder? You mentioned James, but I'd love to hear a bit more about that story.
There's nothing I love more than talking about my team. It's like, I honestly have the best team. I have the best in all possible ways. You know, first of all, they were all cherry picked. Right, because obviously I worked, you know, as an Italian woman in the UK, I started working in the early 90s on a trading floor. So I had it quite difficult. I was an investment banker for a long time, and I culture was always a problem. You know, I never lived in easy, cozy, you know, women-friendly culture. That was not what I experienced. So I wanted to build a culture that was really based on the values of real genuine collaboration, real genuine capability. Mm. And so I want people capable with lots of ambition, but not with a bad ego that sometimes I saw in organizations. And it's not easy to find people that are capable, but also great work with, and fundamentally nice, genuine, solid people. I got a collection of them now. And the good thing is they all know each other. So you just find two or three, and then they know somebody like them. And suddenly you got this team. So I started, there are some key people. So my chief product officer, Liz, she used to work with me at Coutts. She then went off having children. And I was waiting for her to be ready to come back. And the moment she came back, off she came, and we built this together. And then, of course, James, my CTO, I went to four CTOs before finding James. And I really like James because he's like this Northern Irish person that trusts nobody, takes no...
A great balance.
Yeah, balance. You know? He takes no prisoners. And I went, yeah, that's the guy I want to look after my technology.
You mentioned you went through four. Just curious what that process
because,
was like.
At the beginning, first of all, I didn't know what good looks like. You know, so I there are lots of people in our sector that like to say that they can do something. I believe them. And then you realize, no, you cannot do what I need. So, you know, maybe I'm going to be completely politically incorrect, but most women I know, if they know how to do 98% of the job, they will say to you, I don't know how to do the job because there's this 2% I don't know how to do. But they found out with the men is the opposite. So you have to go. I'm sorry for all the men.
No, but there's data that proves that. Yeah, you know, men tend to overestimate.
So I didn't know what it would look like. And I had to go to that experience. And everybody, and also I didn't have a lot of money at the beginning. The pool of talent was limited.
Just on that, in hindsight, is there anything you would have done differently?
Yes, that's a good question. And actually, that's a good tip for other founders. At the beginning, I thought that because I was not a fintech entrepreneur, everybody knew better than me. So I stopped listening to my gut feeling.
The gut is so important.
I stopped it because people would say, that's what you need to do. That's good for you. That's what I would do it. And I wasted so much time and I made so many mistakes because, you know, I remember, for example, people say, oh, you're a SaaS company. You need to have SaaS people that sells people. And I went, oh, my God, there must be this magic formula to be a SaaS salesperson and all this thing. And then there was a moment where I went, you know what? I just want to follow my gut feeling. Yeah. And that was transformational for me because I knew how to do it. I just didn't believe it.
I think that's so important because as a founder, you get advice from all directions
people,
and you really have to just discern, okay, what should I taking? And just based on your experience, your knowledge, what is it that you should actually follow?
It's true. And I think actually making mistakes is a good thing at the beginning, because there are certain things that you can't imagine or think or theoretically know, but there is nothing better than a car crash that you have to survive. Right?
Yeah,
you
just
go
surviving.
To the car crash, you survive, you will never forget the experience. And for example, my CFO is, I had my CFO in 5 minutes because I had other experience. Okay. So I was able to see what good looked like. And people say, oh, you made, that was a fast decision. No,
it took longer than I thought. Yeah.
I got 5 people really that, it's 5 of us that run the company. But to be honest, we're so flat that it's very difficult. It's not hierarchical. Mm. However, the people that generally, when I'm scared or worried, or I pick up the phone and say, I don't know what to do here, well, help me. My CFO, my CTO, my chief product officer, my chief strategic client officer, Stefano, another Italian, who was trying to retire. And he says to me, oh, I'm retired. And I was laughing inside.
No, you're not. Like, no, you're not.
Saying, you're not retired. You're way too young to retire. You know, it's 30 years of experience in financial services.
Amazing.
In some of the largest organizations, you know, Credit Suisse, Barclays Capital, Deutsche Asset Management. I mean, running large company, really, really strategic relationships. There's no way I would allow him to retire.
Like, not yet.
Yeah. And I have an entire collection of all people like this in the company.
As the team was growing and expanded, how did you influence the team, especially when you get to, you know, growth stage? What did you think about when you're building out the team, the culture and the impact?
So we spent a lot of time with cultural things. Like, this is before COVID. So we used to do, and so everyone was in an office. We're all in New York. So every Thursday we did team demos. There was always, there's probably too much alcohol, but there was always alcohol. We got up and made a really strong effort to promote all the wins and all the failures. We made a really big effort of being really visible in the office, and we wanted people to have fun with Brand and I, because like we're very two different people, but we have fun with each other, and we want people to be able to, you know, we take work seriously, but we still have fun.
Yeah.
And I feel like that when you're in an office all together and you see that, you know, we're both believers that we want to be there, the first guys kind of in the office. We want to be the last people out of the office. We want to be online. We want to be accessible. We want to be, and I think that sets a very clear culture of like, we want to have fun, but we're going to work hard as well.
Yeah. How large is the team right now? Like,
We're about 270 now. Obviously, things have come down a lot over the years. Yeah. I think at the peak, in terms of, I'm not including like our outsourced call center services. At the peak, I think we're about 400-ish.
FTEs, full-time equivalents, full-time employees, about 300 now.
And in terms of driver network?
Driver network, current active driver base, about 23,000.
Now, so you have a lot of employees, and then you have these, you know, external providers. Yep. Had you led a team before starting?
No.
So I would love for you to share a little bit about the nuances of how did you figure out what culture you wanted in the organization between you and Chinedu? Mm-hmm. How do you think about the first few hires? Yeah. Just some snippets on the way you thought about it, heuristics, things that work, things that didn't work. That'd be very helpful.
Absolutely. I mean, when people ask me, what would I change, right? The one big thing that I would change is my approach to building the team, right? I would have done some things much earlier, right? Mm-hmm. If I knew, but hindsight is 2020. I actually were fortunate to have some really, really solid mentors and coaches very early on who we would go to regularly just to talk, chat, share what's
Where did you find these coaches?
Through the Texas Network, right? Then, you know, I worked with Sim Shagaya as well, so I'll go back to him.
People you worked with before,
Get some thoughts from him as well. So that was really helpful for us. But of course, a lot of that learning was still personal, you know, doing research, trial and error, right? You know, you do this and then someone resigns and like, well, they resign. Okay, because I did this. Okay, next time I won't do that, right? But yeah, that was, you know, if I could go back in time, I would place much more emphasis and importance on building the team much earlier, right? making sure that people were motivated, also doing a lot of research on them, understanding their backgrounds, because we also made a few mistakes where we brought in people who are very smart, you know, ace their interviews, but weren't ready for the startup struggle, right? Or people who are very smart but needed like large teams to be effective, right? Who, you know, couldn't be very productive with a team of like, maybe where they were coming from, they had like a team of 20, but here it's a team of like one, right? Or two, you know, your assistant at your table, right?
just more practically speaking, for anyone that's looking to hire, how do you identify some of those things today when you're hiring?
We have a framework we use, and I can't remember all the details right now, but one is energy is super important for us, right? If you're like super smart, but you're not like high energy, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. Like we will take like, you know, intermediate intelligence and high energy over, and that sounds strange, but, you know, sometimes there's so much emphasis on strategy, and I think Ebiya and Chinedu asked ourselves and said, how many strategies do we need in this company? If the two of us can't strategize, then we should be fine. What's the point? So then we realize that, you know what, when we go into conversations and we are dazzled with like strategic insight, it's great, but you know, it's not enough.
Yeah.
So we look for a history of execution. Of being very hands-on, right? And sometimes people think maybe hands-on means that you can't delegate. No. What we mean by hands-on is being very, very involved in the problem-solving process. Mm-hmm.
But does this change across the stages of the company, though?
Yes, it does. It does. So I'd say first maybe 2 to 4 years, you need a lot of people who can really, really execute, right? You also need some people who can still think, right? You know, who are still strategists. That's still super important. As the company scales, at the management level, you then need people who can build teams. And that's where it gets very complex because now you're looking for 3 or 4 capabilities such that if any of them is missing, it still doesn't work.
Mm.
So at the senior level, now I'll tell you, the most important thing at the senior level for us is actually humility.
I love that.
Because what we found is that some of the skills that are needed to lead, they're not really difficult. It's not like they're not that difficult to learn. But what we found to be really difficult was when we had people who are like smart and accomplished, but and felt like they were beyond learning, right?
That just became a super blocker.
It was a massive blocker, right? But people who had experience, had been and done that, etc., but still were humble enough to take feedback and realize that, okay, it's a little different here. You know, it's a little different in this industry. I also don't know it all. I'll bring on team members who will know, who will be more technically capable than I am, but of course, you know, you then provide leadership. We found that humility and the willingness to learn, and also the speed of learning, right, was super, super important for leadership, particularly for leadership, like super, super critical. High energy as well. High energy,
So my co-founder had a PhD in physics and machine learning. So he'd been working on computer vision in the healthcare space. So he had some understanding. He's capable of interviewing people and assessing their capabilities. The first batch of people we hired, many of them are still with the company. I would say that for machine learning talent at that time, we used our London network. And there's a consultancy quite famous now called Faculty who would hire basically science graduates, teach them machine learning, and then try and place them in businesses. And so we went to them and we took one of their graduates, basically, who's a mathematician. In retrospect, I think that that was still a wise move, but I have found when you're starting a business, one thing you should never compromise on early on is talent. And we didn't make compromises, but because we didn't have a lot of cash, we hired quite junior people in certain teams. And in retrospect, I would not do that. I would hire junior people really quite late when you have strong senior people who can teach them.
And you've got the foundations.
Exactly. You really need strong foundations before you can take on junior people.
Yeah.
Because in those early days, how quickly you can make progress really will determine whether you live or die. And I do think that was probably a mistake. We had quite a junior person, fresh graduate. No one really above her who could coach her right. in the right direction.
On the conversation of people, so when you started at FanBytes, was it three of you? Then obviously you grew the business and hired...
about 80 people by the time.
80 people. Talk to us a little bit about how you viewed hiring. You know, what are the key things that you looked for when you're hiring a team and scaling the business? As it's one of the hardest things when building
especially
a company.
Especially also,
right?
you haven't hired at that scale before, exactly. I imagine.
So I think I was a terrible manager at the beginning. And I think by the time we sold, I was less terrible, but I was still terrible.
I mean, love the authenticity.
And the reason why is when I was getting into business, you know, I'd read books about Steve Jobs and all those people. Mm. And I basically equate that the way to win is by being right.
Yeah, I don't know that if Steve Jobs is a good example.
Yeah.
Because no, he was.
Yeah.
He was a tyrant.
Yeah.
And I was then like, oh, yeah, like the way you win is by being like, you should do this now. Yeah. And, you know, and that's the way you lose. Yeah. And
how long did it take you to learn that?
It took me about 3 years.
Okay.
And the big one was when, like, several great employees were leaving.
Mm. So,
well, I think this is my fault.
Yeah.
So, to hire, I think the first one is to, like, shirk your ego.
Yeah.
That was something that I did a lot where I wanted to be right.
Yeah.
And so, because I wanted to be right, it was like I didn't give the space for other people to just input. And then the second thing is actually truly realizing the role of a CEO. I got that wrong until we started to hire some like really credible people.
Mm-hmm.
I think I got that wrong where basically I thought that the questions and the answers needed to come from me.
Every time. It's a common mistake. Yeah.
Everyone, right? Mm. But really, I remember I had a friend say this and it's always stuck with me, which is that a CEO is almost in like the people collecting business.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, man, that's such a good way to frame it. And so those were two mistakes I made, right. I think, at the beginning and to be honest, till the end, where I just thought, man, if only you knew.
Yeah.
But, you know, then I'm not going to do that for the next business, right?
It's a learning process of how to kind of choose your co-founders and the dynamics of working with the co-founders. Like, I'm happy to go through it now, to discuss it now. But I think working with co-founders and people actually, you know, like friends and family that you know from before is very delicate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you need to do it a couple of times to understand how like very complex the relationship is with a co-founder, right? So it's more like marriage in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you have a personal relationship, so I have with Yara and with my current co-founders as well, it just complicates it very much.
Mm.
So I really don't know how to explain it unless you have to go through it and experience it. So I've experienced that like 4 times.
No.
Like almost like, yeah.
Well, that means you've had quite a positive experience then, I'm assuming, because I mean, you hear all these horror stories, don't do business with friends. And people tend to steer away from doing that. So I'd love to understand, you know, what have you done to make it work?
So, I mean, we've tried a lot of things, right? Yeah. So along the four, like, startups that I did, there was always this family or like friend member. And you try different things. So at the beginning, it's like, oh, like everything is like we're together in this. Like, you know, you're building and like doing the personal relationship with the work relationship.
Yeah.
And I think it's very... it's a very tough road to take because whatever it is, the ups and downs in the startups, it will affect both. And then you're just putting all the eggs in the same basket. So you like what I've learned is that you have to be very mature from the early days and ask yourself a question is like, is that remove the relationship? There's also this, maybe the term I would say is a bit of, I'm doing it, but I will say the term. There's a bit of laziness.
Yeah. In just going with people
It's going to people that you know.
Interesting. That's a contrarian view. Because some people would say like, you know them, you've worked with them, you know their quirks, they're the safest bet. But you're like...
Of course. I'll say that as well.
Wow. Such incredible insights
shared
by our guest there. Now,
I think it's really interesting because when you're building a team, you need to find the most talented people who are willing to work for almost like half the compensation that they'll get with another company. And statistically, your company has a high potential of failing
than actually succeeding. True.
And bringing on board the right people can make or break your business.
Yep.
It can be the thing that really changed the trajectory of your business, right? And so I guess when we're thinking about like, how do you really build a world-class team? I think Julia shared some really, really interesting insights in terms of oftentimes the worst hires that she's made are those that she's been really time-bound and had to rush.
Yeah.
And actually, you should really take your time with it.
It's kind of like that, hire fast, fire very slow. But I completely agree with that sentiment because on Julia's episode, she's an experienced founder. So she's had like, I think, three startups. And in fact, ironically, she chose to do her last startup solo and then hired like a team, which I thought was interesting coming from that perspective.
Actually, particularly as there's this whole stigma around solo founders, right? But I almost believe that you want to bring on board the right co-founder.
As opposed to just any co-founder.
Because we all know co-founder breakups can, again, make or break a business.
Yeah.
Right? And so being very intentional about bringing on board the right people is absolutely key.
I would even say like, if you're like an operator, like thinking of an idea, you should think of the team as much thoughts and being deliberate as you would the idea. I actually think the team almost even trumps the idea.
It's a people thing.
It really is.
It's the people that make or break the business.
And to be honest, like, we're both investors. I see 250 deals a month. And when you get the deck, the first thing...
It's the team slide.
Yeah. Like, even if the problem, you know... And I always give the team the benefit of a doubt. Like, even if it's not making sense, I'm like, okay, maybe I'm not an expert.
Something needs to stand out, right? There needs to be something that makes you think, aha, this founder has what it takes, or there's founder market fit.
To build that company,
That will make you believe that they are the ones to build this business.
That's actually a good point, because I think you kind of touched on it, the founder market fit. You can be a great person, an experienced person, but not for the area that you're building. And many people have opinions around this. I would say, like, especially if you're thinking of a venture backable company, one thing that I've seen consistent through our episodes so far is that there is a fit with who they are and what they're building.
Yeah. And so it doesn't necessarily need to be the industry, right?
Exactly.
If you take Samir as an example.
He didn't have the... Exactly.
He came from building a dating app.
Yep.
Building a fintech. However, what he's great at is that marketing, consumer product.
Tech.
Tech, you know? And that's where the founder market is, as opposed to like that fintech expertise, and where the gaps are in terms of fintech is brought on board individuals,
co-founders, and I think there's also that
complementary skills. There's also
exactly that word, complementary skill set. So if you have skills in one area, you probably want to find another area. Exactly. That being said, I also think it's not as formulaic.
Yeah.
Because then I found, and you know, accelerators are a mixed bag. Sometimes it goes well, especially these speed dating programs.
Yeah.
And you kind of optimize a lot for skill set, but then sometimes you guys just don't vibe.
It's true.
And it's like,
the
I don't know.
Not there.
It's not there. Like, you guys don't enjoy working together. So I feel like I would optimize for, do you enjoy working together? Yeah. Do you get enough energy from each other?
That's something that we should talk about.
Yeah.
Like, when you find individuals, mm-hmm. how do you test that they are the right people to work with? And Tim highlighted that, right?
In he did.
If he was to go again, he would spend time working on like a smaller project and figure out, okay, is this someone that I want to build with for the next 10 years?
Yeah. And one of the things that many, I guess, founders don't know, but investors tend to see, founder drama kills companies.
Yeah.
It's one of the leading.
It is.
I've heard stories. Yeah. Like, I've even seen situations of like such nasty founder fights that it just, the business can't operate because they're just not on the same page. So I think like the founder is the most important thing, especially in the early stages.
Yeah,
there are people who get investment off the back of just their expertise as a team. So that was an interesting one.
I think more practically speaking, in terms of how to actually go about the hiring as well, there's something really interesting there. And I think if we listen back to our guests, they've approached it so different, right?
Yeah.
So Samir, for example, worked with his friends.
And then he said, don't work with your friends. I think about it a bit more specifically, which is interesting.
And then he co-founded his previous business with his brother.
Yeah.
Tim, on the other hand, met someone at an event.
At conference,
and they immediately aligned. But I think that when you're thinking about not just like the co-founders, yeah. the broader team, it's really important to think about the way in which you go about hiring. Because oftentimes you can think to the job boards and recruiters, but actually job boards are not the most effective because the best people are going to be in roles. They're not necessarily going to be looking at the same time as you. And then when it comes to recruiters, I mean...
I'm not a fan of recruit. I just even really think like at the earliest stages, one of the signals most investors are going to look for is, can you get a high quality team on board? Exactly. In fact, I would say that you being able to hire, not even hire, get someone on board to join you is a strong validation of whether or not your problem is worth it. And yes, there's nuance around that because like not everyone has the networks or whatever, but can you get someone who's experienced? Like, can you get someone who has complementary skill sets? It's a high quality talent that any other company would die to get, but you were able to convince them on board. That says something
and
about...
And it's validating because at that time, you've got little credibility.
No money.
You've got no money.
You're not offering the soft life. You're
don't
just
have
like...
any track record. And you're really having to hustle. And so that is a really great...
I think that would be the first thing.
But it does require hustle, right? Because like I said, oftentimes the best individuals are already in a role. And so you should really be looking 6 to 9 months.
And actually...
some of the best founders I work with actually are constantly hiring.
I feel like you can't... You have to have this mindset of being very open.
Yes.
To connecting with people, to figuring how you might mutually achieve goals in the context of your business. Like, I completely agree. You meet people and you're already thinking, you're like, this person, I need to get this person in the business at some point because we're so aligned, they're so ambitious, the skill set aligned. The other thing I would say is, and this comes through a lot of our episodes, Tim met his co-founder at a conference. Julia was introduced by mutual friends. Like, people meet at MBA school. Your co-founder is probably in your network. And I see a lot of people who say, oh, I would just... Exactly. And I'm like, the chances that they're in your network is high. But I think that where people go wrong or think about it a little bit differently is that they don't want to share the idea. Like, they don't want to... It's so early... they feel like, am I putting myself too out there to say like I'm looking for a co-founder?
And I'm on the other side of that, because I actually think that you should put yourself out there, because at the end of the day, you can have an idea, someone else can have an idea, and in reality, someone is going to copy your idea.
Literally.
But at the end of the day,
it's execution.
And so you going out there, telling people what you're going to do, harm in doing so.
I also think approach matters, right? So in Rich's episode, like he directly asked his co-founder, like, hey, I'm building this thing. Do you want to come on board? Yeah. Some people are more direct than others. And you know, co-founding is like a bit of a marriage. So there's also the style.
It's harder than a marriage. Honestly,
like, so you also then need to figure out, like, do you go out and say, oh, I'm looking for a co-founder? Yeah. And does that make things weird? Or does it make it like down to it? I don't know.
It's a people thing, right? Different strokes. And so I think it's really important to build those relationships. And then...
it will naturally emerge.
But sometimes you do just need to be direct about it.
And be like, really, hey, this is what I'm thinking.
No, that's really interesting. But just coming back to the earlier point, I think the one thing that's really key as well is if you're hiring for specific roles, so less so the co-founder and so on, you really need to set yourself a benchmark. And one of the ways in which you could do that is by meeting other people who are top within their game in a particular function at other companies.
Yeah.
Get to know them. And then in speaking to them, you'll know what good, great, and bad looks like. And you could use that as a benchmark. And the probability that they know someone else that does a similar function to them is very high.
Actually, that's such a good point on network effects. There's this thing that people say, like, A-class players hire A-class players. Like, so if you get high-quality talent, do not underestimate the ripple effect on the quality of, you know, broader talent that you would bring into the company.
I think that... coming back to the point that Julia made around hiring slow, that is so, so key.
I think
because
so too.
The trade-off on quality becomes harder to reverse as the company gets larger.
But Sameh actually, well, he didn't have an opposite point, but maybe it's the same point. But he essentially said, don't hire people, don't default to your friends because that's the safest option. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
Which is actually similar to Julia's points. Like, hire, so take your time with the people that you bring on board. How long should that be? Maybe there isn't a specific number.
Yeah.
But I guess, like, if we're to think about what a good point is it more incremental. Let's work on something together. Let's see if we work well together.
And that's exactly what Samir did. Yeah. He had worked on advisory projects with his co-founders for Menzel and realized through that, okay, we could actually work really well together. Yeah. Let's build this company together.
Yeah. And if you decide to take the solo founder route, which Julia did for her third company, Planet FWD, and raised tons of funding. So it's possible, but she was a serial entrepreneur. Yeah. So you have to put that into consideration. As a first-time founder, as a solo founder, might be a very hard thing. But if you're experienced and you wanted to go solo, one thing that came through her episode was that she very quickly hired a high-quality CTO.
Yeah.
Someone who led tech very early.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. And I think what's also interesting is thinking about quality, right? And so you can hire many people. I mean, the era of, you know, growth at all costs is definitely gone. But just thinking about hiring for quality over quantity is really, really key as well. Because if you have great hires, one great hire is worth more than three sub quality hires, right? And so I think the key is to incentivize those that you work with to have more impact per capita.
I love that. I like the idea of that, like the ROI per capita on your hire, because one great hire is almost, I actually even think that's not a good math, like 10 mediocre hires is actually not one great hire, because one great hire will avoid issues that that might cause you to need to hire more people. So it's kind of false equivalence, but I really like the idea of the ROI per capita.
And it compounds, right?
It does. Because
those initial hires, your first four hires, are going to be involved in the hiring of the next 10.
They shape the culture of your company.
And they're going to be responsible for the hiring of the next 10, 20 hires. And it has a compounding ripple effect. Yeah. And so ensuring that you're hiring A plus people
is important.
The beginning is absolutely key.
And I would say, like, especially if you are a founder who does not have a technical background.
Yes.
It's so important.
And I loved how Rich shared perspectives.
Yes. He was in a sense lucky because his first investor didn't overthink it. But like the traditional,
but it's rare, right?
It is.
Ideally, you do want to have a technical,
especially if you're building a technical product. But yeah, I think that if you don't have a technical background or you can't build initial versions of the product, it does help to very quickly start thinking about where you might, you know, meet these people. And to be honest, you know, there are several ways you could do that, but they're likely in your network. Get the word out there. Try to get people who see, who've heard what you're trying to build and also have heard the other side and say, you guys should probably talk to each other. There's so many, like, co-founding relationships. In fact, in my experience so far, like with the founders that I've backed or seen, they know each other from before.
They do.
And they don't even have to be close. Like, they just could be, we went to school together, we attended a conference once, we did this, and you're like, so the your co-founder is statistically likely already in your network.
For sure. One thing that I actually wanted to touch on, though, was compensation, because it's something that is a bit of a touchy subject.
Yeah.
And it's really key.
Right? Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, like, you're hiring people and you're not able to pay them the compensation that they could get elsewhere. And I think one thing that's really key is you need to be upfront.
I'm not going to be able to pay you Facebook or Google's.
Yeah, because I mean, I've spoken to a few companies that, you know, have wanted to pay the individual's market rate. And if you're looking at AI engineers, for example, market rate will have you paying very, very high.
Yeah.
Like, your burn will be really high. I think it's about being really upfront and also just giving them ownership.
Equity is a huge tool.
Don't be afraid to part with ownership, because at the end of the day, wouldn't you rather have a piece of a larger pie
than 100% of zero? This is such a good point, because it's a practical point. All of this is nice, yes, you know, get the, you know, motivate them on board, but the talent, they're like, I have a mortgage, I have kids, I have responsibilities, how do we make this work? So this, and I think Rich touches on this as not necessarily from a team perspective, but it's relevant. Sometimes this is where funding comes in. And it's also a validation of your idea, because then that allows you go hire like talent. But that being said, what I would say is that I personally don't think it's a strong motivation for investors for you to say, I'm raising so that I can go and hire someone who can build this company. And then you're like, okay, so why are you there? So like, for, I would say, like, definitely there has to be a trade-off on earning, because at an early stage you can't pay what you would pay other people. But I would say that we should not underestimate the importance of people wanting to build something that has meaning and a high upside. It's the best of both worlds. Yeah. There used to be this saying at Uber that when you get a chance to join a rocket ship, you don't ask what seat. You just get on. How many times do you have rocket ships launching? Yeah. And then someone says, hey, you know, we're launching next 2 weeks. I remember, I think, the CEO of YouTube at some point joined the Google team in the earliest stage. And I think that she had another job, either at Intel, I can't remember right now, but it was a large job. And then she made that leap and joined. Why? It was clearly not because of the money. Yeah, it was the potential. And she was like, I'm going to join these two crazy guys and I'm going to leave my high-paying cushy job, tell my partner that, I'm doing this crazy thing. Why? Because I feel like I truly believe in what they're building and I think that I can help them get there. So don't underestimate the power of storytelling and pretty much impact and selling the upside to getting really high quality talent on board.
Yeah, and that translates across all areas from speaking to investors, speaking to your potential employees, speaking to customers. The ability to storytell is absolutely key, but particularly when it comes to building out the team, because you just can't compete with the market rates. And so you need to sell your vision.
And then in terms of like other flip side, you know, things people have done on the team side that probably cost them much more than they should have. I know in one of our episodes, I think it was Richards, where he was like, you know, he would have hired people who have a bit more experience earlier because you have this tension in the early stages of the business where you don't have money. So it's like, okay, should I just hire junior hungry talent? But
then they have to upskill.
And then it's like, they don't know what they don't know.
And speed, momentum is really important, right?
Yeah, it's like that tension. Also, the tension of not hiring like someone who's super senior but used to working in large corporation because can't get their hands dirty. Yes.
It's a massive adjustment. Yeah. Having all these like corporate infrastructure that enables you to focus on your job. Suddenly that falls away
and you're the only
navigating that at a startup can be a real challenging transition.
So I think
finding individuals that are senior, have the experience, also have the
can get their hands dirty. And it's hard to recruit for that, I imagine, because people sometimes do very well in interviews. And another thing that I think is also important, now that I remember one of the episodes, is like people try to meet people outside of just work. So it's like just trying to connect with people meaningfully. It's like, I just need to know who you are because we're going to be going through terrible things together, because nothing, you know, in a business is never a straight line. Like when we lose that large client, like when things happen and, you know, stuff hits the fan, who is this person and how will they show up?
And actually, this is a preview because one of our upcoming episodes, one of the founders actually shared how he took the founders to his hometown in the US.
Yeah.
And that for him is where he realized, these are people that I want to build
spend
with
time
for the
with.
Next
yeah.
Years. So just removing yourself away from the office and getting to know who they are as individuals.
Makes all the difference. So you all should go watch all the episodes so that you can get all the details into these little tips that we've shared so far.
Amazing. Thank you so much, and tune in to the Startup Leap across all channels.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Startup Leap, TSL for short. Leave a review, tell us what you think of this episode on all our platforms at the Startup Leap Pod. Do you have a question? Ask us and we'll ask our guest. Go to thestartupleap.io. See you next time.